Hello there. I'm sorry I arrived a bit late with the usual problems of getting here with Deutsche Bahn, German Rail. So I'll be talking to you about playgrounds. So things are going to get a bit smaller in dimension compared to the school buildings. And if you talk about how playgrounds have developed in the 60s, really, you need to take a step further back in history to understand how playgrounds emerged at all and what the idea was behind them. But people who work and research on playgrounds, and there are only a handful of us, and there is no great long history of playgrounds because historians haven't necessarily looked at this subject particularly much. Recently, it's been researched a little bit more, not least by the playground project of Gabriele Burkhalter. And what was exciting about that was that it started with a taxonomy of the various different types of playgrounds and how they developed. But what we know about playgrounds in the 19th century is not very much. The first German playground was 1790, apparently, at Jochimsthaler Gymnasium, which was opposite the city palace, and Friedrich Wilhelm II kept going past this school every day and was really annoyed that in this Prussian elite school, young people after school were stormed to the streets right after school and hung around there. And so he basically donated money for a pen to keep them in it with a wall around it. And they were supposed to play there. And Theodorich said, while we seem to be playing, we are actually serving the fatherland. So the playground was always the object of various different aspirations in the UK and in the US. It was a movement within philanthropism. There it was about in the industrialized city where children were released, at least working class children were released, and you were supposed to get them off the streets into the playground. So in the 19th century, this was a counterpoint to the streets, which was considered a problematic place for children. So they had to be pulled off the streets and put in a sort of pen where you could watch them better. And what emerged out of that was a kind of standardization of playgrounds, something which was called the 4S in the USA. And you see this in a lot of playgrounds. There's a slide, and a swing, and a seesaw, and sand. So the idea of the playground being a sort of supervised pen, in the way that Foucault described it, this sort of milieu of locking people up, locking children up, in a sense. And then from the late 19th century, this was the target of criticism within the framework of what we might describe reform pedagogy. Very early on, a debate emerged where people were saying that these places don't allow children to do what they should be doing in terms of their own activities. They don't allow children to experience things the way they should. They don't allow children to sort of cross boundaries. And so adventure playgrounds were suddenly considered a playground that makes it possible for children to experience adventures. But that meant that adults should stay away from this playground, or else they should just help the children get on with their adventures. And the focus was the children organizing their own activities. So this adventure playground idea was one that developed quite quickly. But at the same time, it was the Second World War that interrupted these ideas, because that was from the 40s. And then after the Second World War, it was about restoration or reconstruction as well. But from the 50s on, there was a movement looking at how to open up the playground and allow it to not be such a locked-in pen. So a physical deboundering of the playground. It's about space, spatial production of space for and with children. So it was allowing sort of artistic design to playgrounds, and also politically overcoming boundaries as well, in a sense. So I'm going to start. Why is my presentation not coming up? So the first image that I'm going to show you here is from Amsterdam, and Ado van Eyck in the 50s basically used empty lots left over from the war and built in them. So, and he sort of installed hundreds of playgrounds in just empty spaces that weren't being used for anything. So Ado van Eyck was a sort of modern, anti-modern architect. He focused on the reality of people who did architecture like Corbusier in a module, or like a set idea of the subject. So what you can see quite well here is that this playground here doesn't have any fence around it, any wall around it. It's limited only by the road there, so the playground just fits into the sort of urban texture, but at the same time is open to the city. And this was a pretty new idea of the playground that emerged in the 50s here. Now, there are other objects that you can see here. You can see the sort of social housing in Amsterdam, and much like in the case of the other model as well, this playground here just is demarcated by the pavement, but it's in the middle of the sort of the roads there. Here's another example, Ado van Eyck. This is social housing from the period before that, from the 20s, where you can see the very same thing. But this is a movement where from the 50s, the sort of integration of the playground as without barriers that we see here. This is Neuperlach in Munich. This was a housing project installed by the Neue Heimat. And there was a play street. So this play area here is part of the streets there. It was designed in there as the project was designed. Not there anymore today, although it's actually a very interesting project. But all you see are this sort of concrete snakes are still there. Here's an example from Japan where it was done in a very similar way, where there was a sort of half open principle there, sort of semi open plan principle. And then this regarding the physical opening of the playground. At the same time, there was another physical opening of the playground, and this impacted on the actual equipment on the playground. So the examples that I'm going to show now come from France in the 60s there. The Groupe Ludique was set up there, the play group. And this was three people. If you look at the pictures from then, they were kind of hippies in a sense. And they had very specific ideas of how it should be. La Salle, for example, who was one in the groups of these Groupe Ludique, described it as follows. To make a concept of the world in which this trio were there and were appropriating, you have to imagine a space which came up from a superstructure of Buckminster Fuller, a project from Jona Friedman, in which Buster Keeper Jean-Pierre's read Jean-Pierre's poems, where Françoise Dautau presented ideas and analyzed them from Gaston Blachelard, implemented by Félix Guizeret, and the Frank Zappa was involved in the sound. So this gives you a sense of it. If you just have a look at this, this is how you can imagine what kinds of concepts were involved in shaping the space here. Primarily, what they were trying to do was to redefine the play equipment that was there, not the 4S, but rather cubes, pyramids, and just interjecting them into space and creating connections between these cubes and balls and other spaces and ideally making it possible for the children to be able to move it around. There's quite a lot of money for projects at the time, interestingly enough, in accessing the Langue d'Occasions. There are images here from the Grand Mont, which was a sort of holiday resort planned by the state at the seaside. And these have become objects of touristic interest. Postcards were made of them. It wasn't necessarily the idea behind that the group had, but it was a consequence of this. Here are a couple of other examples. But what's interesting here, and Xavier Lassalle once admitted this as well, is that what played a role here was the enthusiasm of the group Le Duc for its own productions. They were very thrilled with what they were managing to create visually and structurally as well. And at this playground here, you can see that it almost looks like a sculptural object. And indeed, this was the other barrier removed here, opening the playground in designer, in terms of design and in an artistic manner as well. In the 60s, nearly everywhere you were seeing playground sculptures of this kind. So this here is work of Gucci, who had some very interesting playgrounds, but the slide here is suddenly a sculptural object as well. And in the US, there was an entire company that looked at play sculptures and tried to create mass-produced play sculptures. It didn't work quite as well as you might have thought, but some were mass-produced as well. A great deal of money was invested in these sculptural objects, in creating them. Art in America, a magazine, had these play devices on their front cover. So it blurred the boundaries to art. Here are some examples from Japan, where the playground also has this sort of sculptural form. Here's an example from the US, where the area of the playground is painted. It looks as if an artist has conceived it. Here's a very famous adventure playground from Richard Detner in the US, which is in every single catalogue about playgrounds. And here you can see how the artistic and the design approach has taken place architecturally, because this is almost designed as its own urban space, this playground. Though it's important to be aware of the fact that playgrounds in the US were very much seen as part of park design. And so they were always sort of integrated as part of these parks. The Gutai group from Japan have published this catalog a couple of years ago called Splendid Playground, and in a qualitative level as well, working on the assumption of art and blurring the boundary here to the playground. So again, the barriers between the two dismantled here. This was a project of the Gutai group from the early 50s, I think. And here's another example, which is very interesting and is in every catalog as well. This is Palle Nielsen's project, The Model, from 76, I think. 67, sorry. In the Museum of Modern Art in Stockholm. This was relocated there, where child's play is part of the exhibition. You can see how the adults are standing around watching children playing. But the idea was to have a model of a different type of society in the children's games here. So massively problematic in terms of its voyeuristic aspect, of course, but still very interesting when we look at the whole question of boundaries. So the physical side, the design side, and the third would be the pedagogical barriers that are dismantled here. So what actually happens, or what is supposed to happen at the playground, serves a different pedagogical approach than we would have had with the four S's. Fitting in with the reform pedagogical ideas that we saw, for example, in the laboratory school in Bielefeld, the Laborschule in Germany. This was pursued massively by the Keks group from Bavaria. complicated names, cybernetics and pedagogy. I can't remember what the abbreviation actually stands for. Wolfgang Zacharias was the driving force behind it. And they had a play bus that they installed in Bavaria that was mobile and would go from place to place to revitalize playgrounds or to revitalize certain urban spaces. And the pedagogical aim was, of course, to foster the activities of the children themselves. And at the same time, this was a sort of campaign within the city to create a political event out of it in which you could look at the role of children in the world. And these pictures look very different here, of course, than they did in the, when we were looking at these sort of empty playgrounds with sculptures. There's really lots happening here. They had projects where they just took a bunch of chairs, put the kids on these chairs, and took these chairs right through town and played with the chairs in various different places, which at the time caused serious waves and outrage about how children should be raised, etc. And this is pretty classic as well. Adventure playgrounds were called junk playgrounds, this one. So it was working with stuff they find there, leftover junk, basically. It was part of the idea behind this playground here. Here's some impressions from the work of the Cakes group. And this changed the sort of equipment at the playground for the children to play with. This is an American designer here who designed this equipment for the playground based on the idea that children have to work together to balance on this rope. So if one person comes onto, one child comes onto the rope in a different part of the web, it bounces the other child. So you have to sort of be aware of each other and try to maintain balance. So this was a sort of pedagogical attitude to how equipment at playground should be. Another idea linked to this is the political idea. The fourth idea is the political idea. So the idea was that playgrounds should foster different political aims than they did in the past. So anarchy has an issue dedicated to this subject, headed by Colin Wadd. So it's looking at adventure playgrounds as a model of anarchist coexistence. So it was looking at the emancipation of children from adults on the one hand, but also a critique of society. The group of Cakes, for example, looked at things being depicted as things that can be changed and not just a reflection of the status quo. It was also about fostering participation. So the idea of participation with children here, this is a Gubledik picture. This is an idea that comes across more and more, i.e. children take over the playground and create a space in which they can play. So this becomes a key component. And this is my favorite picture. Then you have situations like this that you just have to accept. Namely that somebody is sawing, a kid is sawing off the board that he's standing on. So that's participation of children, taken to its extreme perhaps. So this entire movement in 1980 was essentially over. And there are a few things that one could say about that as well. Normally, the interpretation is that from 1980, for example, by Gabriele Buchalter, that from 1980 on, it was the case that safety became more important, not least by the people who designed the playgrounds, but also by the public authorities, but also parents were focusing more on safety in playgrounds. So you could no longer saw the board that you were standing on. And the idea of, not that any terrible things happened at adventure playgrounds, but there was also this focus on safety that parents were demanding as well. For the US, this is absolutely the case. In the US, there really was a McDonaldization of playgrounds, but the US have particular liability laws in place. So in the US, it can be possible if there's an accident at a playground that you can sue for astronomical amounts. And that's not the case in Europe. So I think the concept of safety does explain some things, but it doesn't really explain why this investment in playgrounds in the 80s dried up. And what Tom was talking about as well is that the money in the 1980s after the Sputnik shock no longer flowed the way it had in the past. But at the same time, there was an expansion of pedagogical concepts that were tried and tested in playgrounds that had perhaps moved into society. So there's a migration of some of these concepts in things like childcare centers. So every daycare center can now reproduce what the Cakes group considered modern at the time. So if you've ever spent any time in childcare centers, early learning centers, you can see that these pedagogical concepts expanded to include the parents, to include childcare centers. If you visit people who have children, it seems like their entire apartment has become a playground. So parents have sort of internalized this idea that children need to be fostered to play in a certain way. And for preschool children, there was a new playing culture at a certain point, and that was digital. And this, of course, massively competed with the playground as a place to play. So playgrounds no longer have the same function that they did, which led to a reduction in the investment in them, perhaps. And the last aspect that I'd like to look at is one thing that was very successful at dismantling the barriers at playgrounds is this expansion of the playground into cities themselves. This is a book by Colin Ward. And Colin Ward demands in this, and this would be the last consequence of dismantling these barriers at playgrounds,
dass die Stadt selber zum Spielplatz.
And the whole idea is the city itself should become a playground. The city itself should, as an urban fabric, offers interesting places for children to play. And of course, that was a crucial point. It was a crucial critique of the city at that point in time. Colin Ward, in this book, tried, through photos as well, to show how children play in the city, although it's actually a hostile environment. This difficult, derelict city was nonetheless a place that offered scope for children to play. They would take possession of place. For example, they would take a fence that was supposed to act as a barrier and use it as a climbing frame. They would use all the rubbish that was lying around as playground equipment. And here's an image from China. They would take possession of playgrounds. I remember when I was a kid, there was a river that was being straightened out in the small town where I lived, and it was great for children. There was all of this rubbish and earth, and we went and played right in the midst of that. So as children, you would take possession of the city, and Colin Ward said the city itself was to become a huge playground for children, a place where children could learn through play absolutely everywhere. The spilling out and expansion of the playground in the city is certainly something that happened, although not in the way that people in educational theory thought that it was going to look. I'd like to show you some images now from a Jacques Tati film from Playtime, which I guess many of you will already know. And it's about a minute and a half from the end of Tati's Playtime.
The film besteht daraus, dass diese amerikanischen Touristen mit dem Bus.
So here you can see some American tourists going around Paris by bus. So it's the tourist gaze, and that's always something which focuses on the ludic concept. You can see the way in which there's window dressing of the city to focus on those objects. Well, it's self-explanatory, actually.
There's a sack of curls.
Oh!
where monkeys are at.
Und diese Szene ist relativ wichtig, da komme ich gleich nochmal zurück. Ja, also ist klar.
So I think that that point is clear, but the scene which is the most interesting, the city as a playground and as a carousel, is the image where the father, the man says to the child, what's going on? And then the child actually takes the man where he wants to go. There's an inversion of roles. That's what's happened with the expansion of consumerism across society, an increase in consumerism. That was something that had started to emerge in the 60s, but in the 1980s really became forceful. And in the 80s, adults increasingly became children again. So the idea is that the consumer wasn't supposed to exercise restraint at all, but rather to satisfy those desires rapidly. The consumer wants more and more of everything all the time. The consumer consumes without any sense of guilt about that consumption. These are all actually attributes of children. Remember Herbert Grönemeyer in 86, he sung his song Children to Power, Kinder an die Macht, saying that children should be given commando, the world belongs in children's hand, and they're just going to laugh us into the ground, no rights and no obligations. It's a kind of hippie ideal, but it's also the ideal of the consumerist society, no rights and obligations. You're no longer a citizen, but rather you're a consumer. And when adults turn into children, that of course is the point in time at which the playground spills out into the city, and the city becomes the consumerist playground of adults, but then adults and children are tantamount one to another, for they are all consumers. That's diametrically opposed to the concept of the adventure playground, or indeed that of groupe ludique or of cakes. And the last aspect I'd like to address, the role of play per se. From the late 60s and particularly in the 1980s, changed profoundly. If you look at the theoretical experts, Hutzinger, Calois, Luther Gerlich, then play is defined as opening up a particular limited space and time. It's a fictitious reality that is formed for just a moment, and it's not productive, is distinct from everyday life. But in the 80s, particularly in the realm of production and manufacturing, there was the so-called ludic turn there. Play became part of the paradigm of creativity, which was needed for entrepreneurial subjects of all kinds. And it began to take on a new role in that context. So the playground and the city as the playground emerged from the ideas of education. And it's locked into an idea of the city that was actually diametrically opposed, though, to the previous notion in the 80s of the playground spilling out into the city. We started off with the playground as a kind of pen to be in opposition to the city, whereas after the playground spilled out into the city, you could almost say the city is now the pen in which the interest in the child, of the child, is in a domesticated form. There was a very interesting article about a reenactment from 2014. And there, one critic said, well, forget the children, they're already corrupted. It was, of course, a little over the top, but the idea of the spillover that you get, if you look at the images that I've presented. Thank you.